das ist der Kinitorna. Der Kinitor ist Herr. Und so Herr Abdul Chicken. Weil das ist auch ein bisschen der Kinitor.
Can we introduce ourselves and then we'll
welcomed them and allowed them to make their presentation. Okay, we can start with you, Annelie, and then.
Good morning, I'm Annelie Oltrich, and a member of the committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Nick Kuernoff, and also a member of the committee.
Good morning, my name is Lee, and I'm a member of the committee.
Morning, my name is Lee Pujiga, and I'm a member of the committee.
Thank you, members. Okay, now that's the portfolio committee members that you are going to be addressing and be engaging you with questions. What we usually do is that you make your presentation. After the presentation, they engage you with questions. There's no specific thing. They can ask anything, clarities and whatnot. And then after that, having taken all of them, I'm sure you by now you have processed our things, how they're working, how strong they are. So you, after asking those questions, then you can write the questions down and then you respond to all of them. Thank you very much. We'll give over to you, David.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of the Committee. We are very grateful for this opportunity. We would like to do introductions, and then after introductions, have Belinda start with the presentation, and then I'll present the second part of the presentation. My name is Lutando Viva. I am a gynecologist at the CSIR. I'm also a research manager managing the area called Ecosystem Services, which is within the Natural Resources and Environment Unit of the CSIR. We are part of about 14 units and centers within the CSIR, but our focus is on the natural environment. We do research in a number of areas, including ecosystem services, which are responsible for global change, water resources, and the new area called green economy. And we also have a few colleagues from the mining space that have recently joined us. We're going to share work within a very focused domain, but we think that this is important work as identified by the chair and the leader, and we hope that we can show some interesting examples of the work that we're doing that can give you some highlights of opportunities for using science to influence planning and policy. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Belinda Reyes. I am a chief scientist within the unit that Lutando was mentioning. I trained as an ecologist in Pretoria, and I'm based in Stellenbosch with a group of about 20 of us, students and scientists working on the topics of environment and development and the links between the two, with a focus on the Southern African region.
Good morning, I'm Isabel Dali. I'm a PhD student registered at Stellenbosch University. I also sit within the Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services Group at CSIR. My research is focused on increasing the capacity of communities in working landscapes to adapt, to respond, and cope with climate change impact. So basically looking at identifying the drivers of vulnerability and adaptive capacity. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Munir Rasulmani. I'm also a PhD student within the same unit. I studied at Stellenbosch University, and my research focuses on how the natural environment is contributing to meeting development targets. And so we used existing information from the South African census data to explore those options. Thanks.
You want to introduce yourself? You can introduce yourself.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. They are McGilly from again. But I think what is really, what I'm delighted about is that the CSIR is doing accountability stuff. Normally when we come, we portfolio committee, it's about the annual plan, it's about the strategy, and very high level. And this is very specific. It's about something that happens within the units at the CSIR. And I'm delighted that it's proactive, so that in the future, she can have more of these proactive sessions in terms of the content of the CSIR. Thank you.
How I wish the media could know some of the things, and by media I mean the general population could know about some of the things that they are doing. But unfortunately, we don't have a control of the media. They do their own thing. We've been joined by another member, Natasha Lowe. she's the linguist. She speaks Afrikaans very well. She speaks English very well. She speaks Kota very well. She speaks Zulu very well. She knows all languages. In fact, it's because she's coming from an area which has got a rainfall throughout the year. There was no rainfall at all. Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, for this opportunity to come and speak with you today a bit about this topic, a very big topic, our human future, but specifically on the contribution science can make to a good human future, and focusing a lot on the South African contribution that science can make. So the way we thought we would arrange our presentation is I'm going to give an overview on the topic and explore the South African contribution, and then hand over to Zitando, who will take you into a bit more detail, giving an overview of the kinds of projects we're actually doing in this area in South Africa. Right. So, I think before we start talking about our human future, and I hope you're not going to make it a scary human future, it's important to reflect a little bit on our human past and the relatively bumpy journey that we and planet have been on to get to where we are today. So this is a graph that reflects the temperature on planet Earth over the last 100,000 years. And it shows that things were a lot colder and a lot more variable in the past as we and the planet were evolving. So we were basically being plunged from one climate crisis into another as we left Africa, moved to Australia about 60,000 years ago, then started hitting Europe 50 or 40,000 years ago. A really variable and quite a tough planet to be living on until about 10,000 years ago when things started to settle down and temperatures started to settle out at the very pleasant range we find today. And this allowed us to stop moving around, to settle permanently, and begin the agricultural societies and economies that we still have today. And those are really the precursors to many of the civilizations of modern times, including the Greek and Roman civilizations. And this 10,000 years of a climate-friendly planet is commonly referred to as the Holocene. So this Holocene wasn't only a very climate-friendly time, it was also quite a biodiversity-friendly time. And by that I mean it was a time where the planet was inhabited by some very useful species of animals and plants that we could domesticate for agriculture. So it was the time of horses and livestock and rice and potatoes and corn, all very important species in agriculture till today. It was also a time when most of the species were actually quite harmless. No more dinosaurs, no more saber-toothed tigers and mammoths. It was quite a coincidence of friendly nature and friendly climate really allowing us to begin to farm and live better, more permanent ourselves. It was also an interesting time where the rainforest, which had mostly covered the earth just before that, had massively retreated and had been replaced by grasslands and savannas, which are fundamental to our agricultural and urban systems. So a real lucky combination of factors which can really call our 10,000 years of grace, this Holocene period, really seen as a very comfortable zone within which the whole modern civilizations could develop. And during this time, we managed to proliferate and grow enormously as a population from very few million people around in the early Holocene all the way through to the 7 billion we have today. At the same time as we were growing our population, we were also growing our skills and our abilities to harness the planet. And so we also became really good at extracting more water, more energy, and producing more food. And this graph, which only goes back into the mid-1800s, just shows how much better we have become across a number of regions at increasing crop yields. So this is just measuring crop yields in tons per hectare, from the 1800s until current time. And this was a pattern we were seeing across regions, from China to Latin America, India, the UK, and France. Interestingly, this graph also shows in the middle of the last century, so the 1950s, just after the Second World War, we see a sudden upswing in how good we are getting at living good lives. So we suddenly went from producing sort of 2 tons per hectare to within a few years being able to produce double or triple that, which was a sudden upswing. And interestingly enough, here are many graphs that have been put together showing a period from the mid-1700s until now, and they show a range of social and economic development measures showing the same sort of thing, that we'd kind of been doing our thing until the 1900s, and then suddenly we got really good at Boeing, at developing our economy, so you can't read all the text there, but it shows, you know, the GDP, the amount of paper, the urban population, the number of cars, the number of telephones, the number of McDonald's restaurants, which is quite an interesting one, suddenly booming in the last 50 to 60 years. And this is what has been called the great acceleration of human enterprise. So we really figured out how to live well and how to develop well in the last 50 to 60 years. And countries as we think of today are extremely well developed. We're very poor countries. Most of Scandinavia was still living in abject poverty before the 1950s. So really seeing a lot of very developed countries making their mark in that time. At the same time, we see some variables starting to show the same acceleration, but in the human imprint, the human impact. So those ones at the top there, you've all heard of the greenhouse gases associated with climate change. So we also see the same upswing in things like carbon dioxide, nitrous oxides, and many of the biogeochemicals making up our planet really starting to change fundamentally in the 1950s. And at the same time, we see those changes happening in our ecosystems. So in our coastal systems, our coral reefs, our tropical forests, all starting to show the same sort of growth of impact picking up and becoming exponential at that time. And so this has led many people to suggest, well, perhaps we are leaving the Holocene. We are changing, the world is changing, the planet is changing in very substantial ways in the last 50 years. This graph just summarizes 9 important variables that describe our planet Earth. So the gases and chemicals that make up our planet, the biodiversity, the water, the acidity of our oceans, those are all captured here. And what you see in the green circle is where those variables were in the Holocene time. And what you see in the red is where they are today. So quite a few of them were still within Holocene conditions. For example, our ocean pH levels are still within Holocene-like conditions. Our fish water use is still within the kind of levels we saw in the previous 10,000 years. But for 3 critical variables, for climate, for species and biodiversity, and for nitrogen, we are so far out of Holocene, we are actually almost changing the way the planet works and looks. And this has led many to suggest that we have left the Holocene for what has been called the Anthropocene, the age of humanity. So it's being proposed that humans have dominated the planet to such an extent that it's actually become like a geological force, shaping the planet, its processes, and its functions at global scales. And this was highlighted in The Economist in 2011, and there have been several follow-up articles in a similar vein, really raising awareness of the force that we have become within the planet and within our environment, so this new age. And there are lovely videos for us on the internet. Elias, yesterday I showed some of them, but I can't. So that would have given you enough breaks on my voice as well. But there are some lovely resources to explore this even more. But I've just got 2 examples here of what we mean by the sort of shaping and the forcing that humans are creating on the planet. So if you look at these maps, the top one shows the area of croplands and the bottom one shows the sort of farmed pastures and rangelands and their extent across the Earth. And so we've basically engineered about a third of the Earth's terrestrial surfaces to produce more food. You know, we're much more food secure than we were 50 years ago, and we've reduced hunger in enormous ways. So we've done a great deal, but it's changed the way the land looks. And similarly, we've been very efficient at storing water and moving water around the landscape. South Africa is a fantastic example of how our cities are not where the water is. So our engineers and our hydrologists have become very proficient at storing water, and I think more than 60% of the world's water now sits in human-made storage and transfer systems. And what's interesting is NASA has actually picked up that has affected the speed of the Earth's rotation. Not in a scary way that's going to send us hurtling off into space, but just an indication of how we have become the kind of force that can do to the Earth what meteorites do, what ice ages did in the past. We are a geological force. So what does this mean for our human future? And this is, Honourable Chair, where I hope I'm going to be less scary. And, you know, I think that This idea of the Anthropocene, many might interpret it as a story of doom and gloom and Armageddon and all the movies that Hollywood would like to show us about the day before yesterday or whatever those things are called. But it might also actually be a very good human future that we could have in the Anthropocene, a future where we manage to address some of the woeful failures of the Holocene, failures around human health, around inequality, around our relationship with the environment. So, you know, we still really are sitting at this kind of bifurcation where we can start articulating the kind of Anthropocene we want to live in. There will be some challenges. These are just a list of some of the big global challenges that I've drawn down to show, you know, the kinds of things we're going to have to get right if we're going to have a good Anthropocene. We have to feed 9 billion people by 2030, that's how many of us there will be. We want to be able to reduce these risks being caused by extreme events like earthquakes and floods and storms. We want to be able to transition to low carbon societies to manage climate change. Most of the world's population is going to live in cities in the very near future. We want those to be healthy, productive, and risk-free spaces. We need to do a lot in improving human health. In South Africa, we see that scenario very clearly. We also need to do this while making sure that we can live in a warmer world. We want to make sure that we're being equitable in the consumption and production of food, water, and energy, and other resources. We want to increase our resilience to future changes that might be along the way, and by this I mean future financial change, future political change, as well as future environmental change. And we also want to make it an Anthropocene that's filled with opportunities and innovation and jobs and income from this transition to a good Anthropocene. So we're creating a culture of abundance, really, within this Anthropocene. But what we need to remember is we want to do it while staying quite briefly in the conditions we understand from Holocene. You know, the more we move out of the green bubble there, the less we understand about how the planet will react. We've seen that a little around climate change, we've seen a bit around some of the biodiversity changes, but we don't really know how our oceans and our fisheries will react to extreme changes in pH levels. We also don't know what's happening with the novel materials we're introducing from nanosciences and things like that. So it seems sensible to try and stay in the conditions that we've been in the last 10,000 years, which has allowed us to proliferate in the way that we have. And so I think this is always a lovely graphic of trying to summarize what a good Anthropocene might look like. On the outside, we have those planetary processes, the chemicals, the biodiversity, the climate, and we kind of want to stay within that safe bubble of what we understand and know and what helps us live happy, healthy lives. But at the same time, the inner circle shows the social development and economic development imperative that we need to create a safe and just age. So we're sort of trying to find that green circle where we have enough development for everyone without pushing the planet outside of its boundaries. And that is taking a lot and demanding a lot from science. It's requiring all sorts of knowledge and innovation and information and tools and new skills, like measuring in our students and new capacities within the private and public sector to be able to deal with these trade-offs and manage our security on this changing planet. But I think perhaps most important and the thing we want to talk about the most today is it's also going to require a new kind of science, a transformation of science. It's going to be a science that's less about curiosity and more about what are the problems we're trying to solve and what are the kinds of solutions that science and knowledge and data and tools and innovation can provide in meeting some of these challenges of feeding 9 billion people, keeping 9 billion people healthy, keeping them safe, and keeping our planet safe. It's also making us move more and more out of our disciplinary silos to solve these complex problems. It's no longer enough to have a climate change scientist studying changing climates and a health scientist studying health. We need them to be working together to study health in a changing climate. So it's really about bringing scientists together to work together to solve these complex problems. And perhaps sort of the biggest challenge in some ways is that it requires a global effort. These are global challenges. They have global causes, they have global effects, and the solutions are going to be global. So it's not really possible anymore to say that the deforestation in the Amazon is Brazil's problem if it stops to affect rainfall patterns in Africa. We can no longer say Ebola is West Africa's problem when we see the impacts it's having on Africa and the world. And we can't really say, well, poverty alleviation is the developing world's problem. We see the links between poverty and global security and global development as well. So these are really the kinds of changes we're already seeing them in science, and specifically I think we're seeing a lot of these changes in science. We're getting teams of scientists solving problems, developing solutions, and interacting with others in the region and the continent and the world, in fact. And this is really where this new platform that I was speaking about with the Honourable Chair is trying to head. It's a platform that was recently released, a global research platform that aims to bring together the natural and the social sciences, the big global stakeholders, the UN programs, funding bodies, and the development agencies. It was launched in 2013, and it's really a desire to try and effect the kind of transformations I was talking about in science from global to local scales. And this is just a download from their website. So Future Earth, which is the name of this platform, is very focused on science in the Anthropocene and science about a good human future in the Anthropocene. It aims to provide the platform to develop the kind of knowledge needed to accelerate our transformations and our movement towards this good Anthropocene. It's focused very much on solutions. So why is Future Earth in existence? Why do we need this kind of science? What are the big challenges? The food security, the health questions out there. It focuses very much on what the science needs to produce. I think we're moving into a world where it's not just research publications and conference presentations. It's policy, it's products, it's tools, it's media and awareness and all those kinds of things. It also is changing the how we do the science. It's really about bringing together science and society disciplines to co-produce and co-design the kind of science we need. And very excitingly, it's also very much focused on the who. It's a rejection of the sort of northern Eurocentric approach to global science in the past in an effort to mobilize capacities for science and problem solving in Africa, in Latin America, and in Asia as well, really looking at enabling across genders, across geography, and across generations to do this kind of work. This is just a picture of the Science Committee of Future Earth. It's an advisory body for this program, which is mobilizing around 40,000 scientists around the world. It's me and Melissa and Mark Stafford-Smith from Australia who chair this advisory panel. The photograph was actually taken in Johannesburg in South Africa, where we held our first meeting hosted by DST and the NRF. And we have regional representatives, so each region is represented by three members on the Science Committee. So Sheikh Mbawa and Yuba Sakona and I are the African representatives. And this is just a photograph of Mr. Ramesh, who's an Indian politician and economist who has recently been appointed to chair the stakeholder side of Future Earth as well, to really make sure we're engaging between science and society. And we've already begun to see, you know, in the year that we're going, a couple of exciting products emerging from this global collaboration. There was a World Social Science Gathering which aimed to see what the social sciences could contribute in the space. There've been lovely big funding calls from development agencies and research funders. We've been asked to comment into the big spaces like the UN Sustainable Development Goals. There's an article we wrote for them responding to what the kind of science contribution could be to Sustainable Development Goals. And more recently, we're supporting some of these platforms advising on Ebola and responses to the Ebola crisis. So those are some of the examples. What's also quite interesting, the same presentation that the Honourable Chair and I were at was a presentation on South Africa's science and how we've really got a lot to contribute in this space. This is just a graph taken from the Thomson Reuters report on the growth of South African science as measured by research outputs, and you can see a very substantial growth in those from 4,000 to nearly 10,000 research outputs a year in the last 10 years. What's interesting is when you break those down across disciplines, we see a very large growth in areas sort of central to this area of good futures, good human futures in the Anthropocene. We're seeing a real growth in the biological sciences, the agricultural sciences, the earth and related environmental sciences, and these sort of more interdisciplinary platforms that we actually have grown substantially in the last 10 years. And then this graphic, which I really like, it doesn't only measure our output, it measures the impact that the output is having in global circles. How many other scientists are reading and using the work that's being produced? And again, we see this real growth in the impact of areas like the environmental sciences, ecology, and very excitingly, a real growth in the impact of our social sciences around development science, economic science, etc. So I think in that area, I'm going to hand over to Lutello. This is just the website of Future, which is there if you want to find out any more about this platform. But I think we want to spend the rest of the presentation really interrogating the South African contribution to this as well, as was pointed out by the Honourable Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Belinda. I think from here, what we would like to do is to explore some of the examples of the work that we are doing at the CNIR and in partnership with some of our colleagues, both nationally and internationally, to try and do the science that helps to contribute towards the development of a better human future. And I think that work is contributing to national development planning. It is also contributing to disaster risk management, as well as to development, especially in rural communities. South Africa, like has been said, as a water scarce country, and it is one of few countries in Africa that is projected to experience severe water scarcity in the future. And I think that we have done some work in the past and are continuing to contribute in this area and in many other areas in ways that I think are important for contributing to planning for an improved future in water development. In a few years ago, the CSIR led a process of conservation planning in the water resources area in a program called National Fresh Water Areas. And this program was supported by many departments, including Water Affairs, Environmental Affairs, part of the DST, CSIR, and colleagues from multiple research institutions in South Africa, and engaged experts from different institutions as well as stakeholders in trying to understand what are these areas that are key to water provision in South Africa, and how can we conserve them so that we can ensure sustainability of water supply. And I think that the key about this is that a lot of the times when we talk about water service delivery, we're looking at water from the dam to the tap, but this is actually looking at catchment to the dam type of work. And I'm going to show a few slides that demonstrates the value of also looking at these issues afterwards. This slide is a product of that process that I was talking about of working with many scientists using tools to map out areas where that are strategic for water resource supply. And interestingly, these areas that we have marked in circles are the areas in the country that we can refer to as our water factories. And they produce about 50% of the water yield. And yet they make up only about 8% of the surface area of the land in the country. And these areas, interestingly enough, also overlap with some of the other areas like mining and agriculture. And I think the key, especially with regards to contribution to planning, is that when we now talk about development and plan for development in the future, we are looking at a situation where, in some cases, we have to make trade-offs. So the questions then become, how much of this land that is key to strategic water provisioning becomes protected and conserved? How much of it should go or be allowed to contribute to development, for instance, for mining or for agriculture? And I think the other thing that's very interesting about this graph is that if you look at where the water is produced and where most of the water is used, you find that there's a lot of transfer of water to major urban spaces like Johannes Gauteng, for instance, water that's produced in areas like Kangala and as well as the northern Drakensberg, Maluti Drakensberg, supplying water in the Gauteng area in Durban, water produced in the Boland Mountains supplying the Cape. And the key thing here is that we cannot dissociate these large metros and large urban areas where people live from the rural areas and the catchments where the water is produced. There are interlinkages between the two. And I think that is very key to thinking about futures and when it comes to planning for development. There are other parts too, like the contribution that like, the water, like I mean, is making to you know, to our GDP or what is called the gross value add, and collectively these areas that we have shown, these water source areas, are supporting more than 50% of the population of the country, and they also contribute more than 60% of the national gross value add. And that is a substantial contribution, like you know, of a very small area to, like I mean, the national, like, I mean, gross value add from the water, like, sector. And I think that when we think about these areas now, we don't just see, I think we don't see areas necessarily of, like, that must be completely protected. Or when we're talking about conservation, we're not talking about locking up the entire country to conservation, but we can target areas that are key to providing the substantial amount of water that we need as a country when it comes to managing those areas. And I think that is something that is important when it, as a way of informing our thinking about planning for the future. There have been quite a few outcomes of this work. The atlas that is presented to the left of the screen, the atlas of freshwater and priority ecosystems, priority coastal areas in South Africa, is already available as a product that was a product that came from that research, and it is an atlas that is also available electronically for policymakers and for decision making, and I think that is a very important tool, like I mean, that the country has, you know, for large-scale national conservation planning for the freshwater, like, I mean, domain. There have been quite a few media releases, but also that work that we've highlighted here has contributed to the development of sections of the National Water Resource Strategy, and as well as other aspects to respond to some of the areas highlighted in the National Development Plan. But I think there's also been a part about increasing awareness in the society. Like, we undertook a very interesting program like last year, like in collaboration with partners such as the WWF, called the Journey of Water, and there's a story about it in the website that we've highlighted here. But it was basically giving opportunity to people to experience, to walk, for instance, from the catchments where the water comes from into the cities where the water is utilized, and to see that distance, and then, yet to see the connection between the water source areas and where water is eventually being utilized. And I think it's a question about awareness that water doesn't come from the tap, but it comes from the catchment. And I think that making the connection is key to how we manage our water resources. The other area that we want to highlight is an area like looking at how can we reduce disasters and natural hazards in order to protect human life and to protect our assets as individuals or the country. This work was done in partnership with Santam, and I think this is a very interesting perspective because it was coming now from the insurance industry looking at their risk to and their exposure to disasters, which I think when they've done, I mean, insurance companies do a lot of risk modeling, but they do that based on customer profiles. But this was taking into account future climate scenarios and looking at what would that mean for the group of people that the insurance company is insuring. And but also, like, it was also working with the municipality, the local municipality in Eden, looking at trees, like disasters or hazards, floods, and systems, and fire. And this is not a South African or unique South African phenomenon. If you look at the world in general, like the number of geological disasters over the years has generally remained stable. But if you look at natural hazards or weather-related disasters, they have increased quite substantially over the years, and they're continuing to increase. And so, and this is as a result of like changing climate. And because of that, we're seeing the same impact at a local level, and we have done work to try and understand the effect of these impacts. Work that we did and will be published in a leading international journal called PLOS ONE has actually, looked at flooding, wildfires, droughts, and storm losses, and it's showing that climate change basically will increase natural hazards into the future. However, one of the things that is important, and I think this is where it's really key for us in the country, is that our contribution to managing ecosystems can actually reduce the impact of climate change on some of these natural disasters. And so even though we can see that future climate are going to result in more extremes of floods, more extremes of wildfires and droughts, if we manage ecosystems well, we can reduce the impacts of those extremes. And I think we will explore some of that a little bit later. We specifically look at invasive alien plants as an example of this. And for instance, when invasive alien plants like water species in the landscape, they are highly vulnerable and they increase the fuel load in the system. So if, for instance, there is a wildfire and they catch on, then the extent of that wildfire can be quite disastrous. And they only use more water than our indigenous vegetation. And so if you look at programs like Working for Water, they have actually used a lot of science developed in the country to understand the impact that they have on our natural water system and the impact they have on our catchment for reducing water supply. But in the last question, speaking about alien plants, and I'm sorry, but basically the species that come into the country, imported for various uses, for instance, for interior plantations, for pulp and paper, for supply, wood, or for household use and industrial use. But then usually they escape from plantations and go into our natural landscape, and the impacts are quite different from our indigenous vegetation, because once they find opportunity, they take over, reduce substantially the amount of other species that are occurring in the space. They choke up the land, and there is no grass and that layer that grows beneath them, for instance, in the case of the trees. And as a result, you have an increase in the amount of runoff when it rains. There is reduced, for instance, absorption of the rainfall because of the effluents that come. This is the chemicals that come from the invasive alien plants. And also, if you burn the soil where that those chemicals now becomes crusty as well, and basically almost like baked area, that allows water to come down increasingly, and that leads to flash floods if you have sudden rainfalls or extreme downfalls within a short period of time, and that is how they contribute to water flooding as much as they contribute to reduced water supply. But also one of the things that we're finding is that the areas that are of where these invasives, for instance, like wattles, are invading, they're also overlapping to a degree with areas of high grazing potential. And I think the good examples of these are in areas like the Eastern Cape, for instance. If you are familiar with the Eastern Cape, you drive for 2 minutes from East London towards Queenstown. You drive around the Sutherland area, you see a lot of the plantations there. But you see also a lot of these wattles coming out of the plantations into farmlands. We've been to farms in the area that had more than 50% wattle invasion, which means you have a farm that is 1,000 hectares, but only about half of the farm is really viable farmland because the other one has been invaded by wattles. And the sawgrass that grows underneath them, there is no, the water supply, is substantially reduced, or the hydrology of the system, or the entire system, has been changed substantially by the presence of these waters. And what a student of ours, Dr. Miller, who was working on this project, did was to do an overlay of the areas where you have high grazing potential in district municipality, as well as overlay that with the areas where water is happening. If you look at the national level, you can see that it's a small level of overlap at the national, when you look from the national scale. But when you compare these areas that are important for livestock production, and also see that that's the areas where you get a lot of black water, then you begin to see the threats to even food security that these alien invasives can actually have. And this is the reason why it happens. This graphic is quite small, but if you look at the bars,
the bar to, like I mean, to the right is an area that has been cleared of water, and that is around of like I mean the two areas that I think on the edge, that the extreme right and the extreme left, basically areas where there is no water, and those areas are areas where you need less land in order to produce more meat. It's basically expressed in hectares per livestock unit. So in the Eastern Cape, in those areas, you would need about 2 hectares when there is no water to have one steer or one large, like I mean, livestock unit. Meaning, if you had a farm, basically, that was 100 hectares, you could keep about 50 animals on that farm. But if you have a farm that is infested densely with water, you in the 100 hectare farm, basically, you divide 100 by 8, and you are basically, you can basically keep in the order of about, 12 to 14 animals instead of 50 animals in that same piece of land. So that is basically the impact of water. It reduces carrying capacity substantially, reduces the amount of animals an area can produce. So someone can have a big farm, but if it's a lot of it is, or a certain amount of it is water, then you can actually have a situation where you have much reduced productivity from that same piece of land. And this has got implications for food security in the country. If you look at our interventions, for instance, in Working for Water programs and other Working for programs, the Working for Water has largely been focusing on water, but I think we probably need to look at programs that look at food security as well when it comes to prioritization of land for controlling these alien invasive plants as well. So there have been a number of projects looking at storing land that has been invaded, and I think that one of the things that has been the contribution of the work that we have done is that the science can help to inform planning of interventions in controlling invasive alien plants. But also we have worked with local authorities when it comes to planning and support for managing infestations. And we've also seen some interesting program sources of charcoal production in some of the rural areas as a way of intervening to control impacts of, as well, to control waters or to utilize as an alternative water for more economic development in a rural context. And lastly, we've seen networks as well where there is partnerships between the municipality, the business community, and the research community to find ways of improving resilience to the district municipality has been a pioneer in that regard. So I think where we see opportunities, especially with regards to controlling invasive alien plants for contributions to planning as well as to land management, in areas in partnerships with departments like water affairs, water and sanitation, environmental affairs, agriculture, fisheries and forestry. But also we think that there are areas that can be targeted for as hotspots for grazing and livestock production that perhaps need to be targeted for interventions when it comes to managing invasive alien plants. And also the data that we are developing can also contribute to prioritizing programs within programs such as Working for Water, the National Land Health Program. So this is the last slide I want you to reflect on, but I think one of the things that this slide shows has been the work that the CSIR has done to analyze a number of challenge areas that have been, or challenges for the country that have been identified within programs such as the Millennium Development Goals, looking at the National Planning Commission Diagnostic Report, and other the government planning tools, and saying how can science contribute to addressing some of these challenges. And I think the kind of science that Linda was talking about that is more solution-oriented and is responsive to societal challenges, the kind of science that is going to help us address some of these challenges, such as eradicating poverty, contributing to rural development and food security, ensuring environmental sustainability, and contributing to development of sustainable human settlements. However, we also see a need for developing skills
nationally and country to actually respond to, you know, some of these challenges. I think I take very well the point that the Honorable Chair made at the beginning about that in science we have to produce world-class research in order to respond to challenges such as this. And that world-class research is not going to be a situation where, say, South Africa is a developing country and so it cannot adequately respond to some challenges. South Africa needs to invest adequately, and we have welcomed statements coming from the Department of Science and Technology and from government in general about increased investment in R&D over the years, because that is basically the kind of response that we need in order to address some of these complex challenges that do not respect any disciplinary boundaries, that do not respect any national boundaries. These are problems that are affecting countries across the world, especially in the developing world, and I think we need to prepare ourselves to respond quite adequately to that. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Tanda. Thank you, CSR. Thank you, Peter. We'll be joined by two other members. I'll introduce them. Ms. Janita Blanche, sitting at the was joined by the council member. Now, it's unfortunate that I can't remember that, because even myself, I'm usually late. If I remember that, they say I'm like a child. I say they must move late, but there is a problem. So I just have to accept whatever apology I want to put forward, we'll have to accept. Remember, this is the work of South Africa, by South Africans for South Africa, in our global world. We've been saying that our R&D must increase like the other parts by it. We must be having about 1.5% of the GDP. And I don't think we're wrong if we're saying that in science and technology, you can't work as a developing country, but we should be working like a developed country because we're competing with the world. As you know, why we thought this was important is that as we are oversighting, we're an overarching portfolio committee. And being an overarching portfolio committee, we need to look at the policies and the laws that they're making. How are they going to be impacting into our future? And this is why we thought that it was important that we know these things, so that we can interrogate all these departments when they do things that we think that they're going to, even if we're not there 50 years down the line, we're not there ourselves, but this land will borrow it from the future generations. So we need to leave it with them in a proper state, so that they don't complain that these ones they cause problems for us. So we need to make sure that we look at those policies. And the other thing is, which is very interesting, is that they say if you get a developer demolishing the land here, building a house, you call him a developer and you actually pay him money. That person is destroying the nature. When somebody destroys the house that you have built, we say that person is destructive. But we don't say that destructive when they're destroying what has been created. You understand what I'm trying to say? When they destroy what has been created, they're not destructive, but they're developers, we say that. But when you destroy what they've developed, what they've created, that is man has created, you say they are this one is very destructive. It's destroying what they're. So there's that balance that we're to make. The other interesting thing is that, you know, things are happening in global world now, that you find yourself not being affected alone, and you get a response from all the corners. I mean, a good example is the Ebola, because it's affecting everybody. Now everybody had to react to it, but the unfortunate part, we seem not to be reacting to things like poverty and other things, because we tend to think it's affecting those who don't have money. But the things that are affecting all of us, that come up and affect all of us, we start sending up and we invest money, but we are not investing money in some of the things. So, remember the happiest birthday, the last interesting part for me, which I never knew, is the son of water. If you look at your melted water, where the source of the water, it's actually the Soto that has got most of the water. So most of the water is actually coming from the Zulu, which is not our country. And it's actually the mountainous area that is produced water. And all that water goes to the sea. Which might bring the question, what do we do with that water that goes to the sea? And we can, if we use the sea water, we're going to invest money. But remember, I'm sorry, I'm curious about that. It's your questions. But it's very interesting, and we need to override all the department. Okay, I've seen a lot of them, but I've seen a lot of them. Okay, but that, Anil.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the fascinating presentation. I think we should perhaps have more time, especially for the Anthropocene era, that we really unpack what's happening and the impact that the human has. In that vein, I'd like to ask in terms of water. You focus mainly on surface water. What about the subterranean water reserves that we do have? What is the impact of humans on that? And I'm referring specifically to issues such as fracking. Are you involved in any research in terms of mitigating the problems that fracking might, or the dangerous effect it might have for our water resource supply, seeing that we are a water scarce country? Thank you.
Thanks, Shane. My apologies for being late. I was with Helga Hoss that's assisting me. So I was with a member of the staff parliament. Thank you. Thank you. I just want to ask about the invasive alien trees, and specifically about the pine trees at Sappi. I mean, Sappi is one of our major companies in South Africa, bringing in revenue and contributing to the GDP. But I've done a bit of Googling since while busy with listening to the presentation. And for one ream, which is about 500 sheets, it takes 6% of a tree to produce 500 sheets. And I mean, I don't know how many papers were printed for the presentation this morning. So we don't actually practice what we preach. We should actually use the electronic format, because we are ourselves contributing to the problem. And 1 ton of printed high-end virgin magazine paper, ironically used for magazines like National Geographic, which normally addresses these problems, for that you need a little more than 15 trees. So how are we going to address the problem? Because in the most of cases in woodlands, and we used to have a vast biodiversity, have been overtaken by pine trees, which have a similar effect as the wattles. Nothing grows under them. They take up a lot of water, and after you can only use the soil for a certain period of time, and then you see when you drive through there areas of land where nothing will grow. Are we going to address the problem? Because I'm not a tablet user for reading myself. I don't use a Kindle. I also love to read a book still. But we have a serious problem. I mean, the amount of paper we use at Parliament, for instance, I mean, and which we read and then throw out, is shocking. I mean, we do recycle. There is a recycle program. But I don't think that's enough. And what about companies that don't recycle? So Sappi, according to me, although they contribute to the GDP, their pine trees and what they are doing is a major contributor to also what you addressed in the part that I didn't unfortunately hear about what we are doing to the earth and to the disasters that are facing us.
It's interesting when you've been following this environment issue. It's actually the most industrialized countries that are very slow in accepting it. but the developing countries are in it and saying that we need to preserve, but the international countries, the people who got money are the ones who are first of all. Okay, Nick.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, I'm probably regarded as an old man in this environment here, but I use my tablet to read all my newspapers and all my magazines, and the one good thing about paper is it's very recyclable, and when you recycle it and reprint it as paper, you use less energy. So it's not so bad, but nevertheless, there's always this conflict between the environment and growth and jobs and whatever. I just want to go back a little bit. I'm more intrigued what, you know, 12,000 years ago, or 12,000 years before Christ, what happened then when there was that spike over 1,000 years into, you know, tolerable climate? I just want to know what happened then. And then secondly, if we are successful with regard to climate change and we stabilize the two poles, is it possible that we will go into another ice age again in the next 50,000 years or whatever? And then if you look at the great acceleration that started after World War II, and, you know, was it kick-started by war? And, I've listened to a German MP last year who said the only way they can solve the problems of Europe to have growth again, because, you know, we look at the global growth of the developed world of 1%, less than 1%. So if you want really economic growth, you need another war in the global. So it was a shocking statement to be made, you know, in Europe. But what I ask you, World War II, the end, was that the starting of what we have seen? And then you call the new age Anthropocene. It was not a more appropriate word from Holocene to Holocaust if we don't succeed in what we should do to protect the environment and really start to live that we want to live and give other generations time also on Earth.
I'm going to say,
I'm saying that I value the presentation and the input that they are doing, but I will abstain since I'm still new in this parliament. I will listen to the elders, chair, follow the elders.
Thanks very much, and thanks for apologizing on our behalf. It was not intentional. Well, I missed some of the presentation because I came at the tail end of it. But you know what fascinates me, I was asking myself a question, but at the same time I said maybe it might not be parliamentary to ask that question, because it might because they don't have the answer to that question which I have. I think it's about, you know, the contradiction between science and religion. For the past few days I've been observing or going through old literature that talks about the evolution of this planet where we find ourselves in, and that at some point you had animals exploding in our form, and you had natural disasters that well, maybe they were triggered by natural phenomena even at that moment, and currently we are the problem from the scientists. And you it's Nick who asked, will we experience the ice age? And I think given what is happening from ourselves, but also naturally, you know, we have volcanic eruptions and other things, clearly it's possible that we're going in that direction. I read an article where they were talking about, I think, into the future, where we will have some hours without light, or some days, three or so many days without light. That can trigger us experiencing cold weather. I mean, if you stay for a week without sunlight, obviously the weather will change dramatically. Yeah, maybe it might be a question and a comment at the same time, because it's not scientific, it feels very complex, the things we are dealing with. And I think that's the reason why the discipline must no longer be, you know, you must not be you must be an engineer who is dynamic, you know, be an MP who is dynamic. Not to go and make your law and go back, go home without looking at the impact and what you need to do to make it user friendly. So, yeah, it's time to try and unravel this mystery called life, which we are trying to do every day anyway. You are there to try and understand what is this thing all about and to give answers to the things that we don't have answers to, or we can't explain. Like for instance, they say, you must just believe. You can't explain it. Even though they've tried in many ways through the scriptures to try and explain this thing, but it's very, very difficult. You go through the book itself, there are many contradictions in there, so sometimes you must just believe that you will be better off. But so, I think it's an interesting thing, Chair, the presentation here by Belinda Reyes and Lutano Zima was quite interesting. I wouldn't mind to listen to it again. And I'm happy part of the area where there is, you know, we will survive with what is in my village. So, Jack, you must treat me nicely so that we can help you with what in the cake. Thank you very much.
The only thing I'm looking at is the whole location, Kado, there's no water at all. So we'll have to go to Limpopo, because they can't go to Lesotho. Lesotho is another country. So we'll have to go to Limpopo. No, that's very much it. Okay, Malin.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. And thank you, Uncle Jane, for the presentation. Very interesting and thought-provoking also. On that slide of the Holocene, where it talks of in the 1950s where there was development, and so where was Africa? Didn't feature at all. It didn't feature. Okay. So just one question. But on the other hand, like, Chair, I agree with you that on the issues of environment versus development, it's a catch-22 situation. I know some stage in Gauteng there was an area where there was huge development that was proposed, and then there were some 100 butterflies. So environmentally, so you can't remove those butterflies, and for a huge development. So I think it's only that type of environmentalist to hold. And that's why also we find in the department that is EIA, so there's quite a
tired of them because of those arguments. But I think the presentation also shows, Chair, the importance of working, especially with the Department of Environment and Agriculture, because then in analyzing the land as to for the water, so that you know what needs to come there instead of just getting land and putting spinach in it. I'm supposed to. It's not a conducive for that. So I just wanted to find out if you have enough capacity at CSIR to advise these departments, or also if you have a program to train as for capacitation for, especially for those departments that you also have identified, environment and agriculture. And I think the chair has covered the issue of not advocating anything. Is the right thing that 1.5 of the GDP should be for R&D. And I think it's something that as a committee we very believe in and believe that we will go all the way in ensuring that it does happen eventually. Yeah, and last was the issue of the water catching, that this wasted water. What can be done, and also the consultation. I was telling a story, there was a primary school in my area where I grew up in Kipkins that continuously won this book, a Kibutu award, cleanliness in the school, and actually the around the community has joined in, and you won't find any piece of data in that area. The school is very clean, but also they've got food gardens and a grade R1 to practice 7. And each grade is encouraged to bring in the morning grey water. So they don't just throw away the water after bathing. They bring 2 liters and water their gardens. The vegetables there, then they donate to the children. But also the school teachers put 2 bathtubs so that you don't open the tap each time they go to the toilet and wash hands and utilize that water. Later it waters the gardens. So the issue of the water catchments, because the scarcity of water, are we looking into that area? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'm not sure that in the right room where you wanted to be. Okay, you're welcome. What were the questions and comments that you need to respond to? As Honorable Council was saying, some of them you don't have to respond, it's just comments. But if you want to comment on them, we'll be happy. But what we were trying to do was to create enthusiasm from the member, which seems to have come up. The only ones that have enthusiasm that is internal, they don't want to take that, is the young ones. Because they still know that they've got a long future in front of them. So thank you very much. And she doesn't seem to know that what we see was actually important to this country. We thought that it was important for political reasons, but we didn't know that it was for industries that they imported it. I think it was a misinformation. And it's interesting to know that even millet, which is a staple food in some rural areas, was imported to it. It's not originally from here. It's even imported commodity or whatever you call it. But thank you very much. Let's do it this way, because we think that you are hungry. Let's have a 10-minute break while you are organizing who's going to answer and whatever. Maybe we'll invite even the PhD students to answer, so that to see whether they're doing well or they're going to pass their own exam. Especially that is not fed by 10. So we want to know whether they're doing well or not. So you can decide who's going to answer what. And then we'll come back after 10 minutes.
keep in touch through the director to provide additional information on that. When it comes to fracking, it potentially will have that is, I mean, science has shown that it will have substantial impact on groundwater sources, but it's been an area that a number of institutions, including the CSIR, has looked at. The work has been, I think the work that has been done, as far as I understand, has been early, phases now. I would need to also provide contact with some of our lead scientists who have been working in that particular area specifically. But I think that there is definitely concern, especially remote areas where freshwater resources are even more scarce, and the linkage then to groundwater resources, to fracking. Another area of groundwater resources that is of interest to the country, where the CSIR has done some work, is also around the impact of mine drainage on groundwater resources. And there is a report that has not been made public on the work that colleagues from various institutions in South Africa, including the CSIR, have contributed to. We are driving investment in capacity to work in acid mine drainage in particular, but in post mine neglect stage in general, to look at how can we improve the management of these landscapes to reduce the negative impacts that extraction of resources usually leaves on these and the communities that are associated with these areas. And so I think this work that is happening, but I think both Bill and I were saying that there is more work that needs to go into in investing and understanding our nation's groundwater resources and coupling that with our freshwater systems, so that we can have an understanding of the total budget of our water resources. But I think, again, it points to the fact of the value of understanding the entire value chain of water provision in South Africa. Because some impacts have got to do with the quantity of the water produced, but others also have to do with how you manage that in order to ensure quality, because acid mine drainage doesn't necessarily affect one quantity, but the quality of the water due to the pollution from the mineral resources. I think that so those are things that we still need to continue investing in addressing and quantifying, so that the that information is readily available then for formal planning and policy.
And so I'll be responding to the question on pine and forestry and paper. And I think it's a very complex issue, and I'm very close to our hearts as well. I think it mirrors a lot of situations in other sectors, that the forestry sector is an important source of economic growth, of jobs, and those trees were brought into the country to grow the economy and grow industry, and nobody knew then that they would escape, that they would use so much water, and that they would cause so much fire. And so I think the situation that we sit with now is similar to many sectors, is how do we keep that sector contributing to part of the economy and part of job creation, but manage its impacts. And I think you pointed to very relevant parts of that, the decoupling much of our work from paper, although tablets themselves have their own special impact on our resources too. But generally thinking more clearly about efficiency of use, of recycling, and those sorts of strategies are one. And then the other is really thinking a bit about how we manage these plantations and where we book them. And so there's been a lot of work, I know, for example, in the Western Cape around water-scared areas and removing no more pine plantations allowed there because of their impacts on water. There's also work with the forestry company that we've been involved with around how they manage the plantations, how they, their responsibility to prevent these escaping aliens into the landscape. And also how they manage their selling practices, and this is something that Yael will talk to a little bit later to pass her exam. I think it's highlight for us the real complexities that we're dealing with here, that it's not enough to leave the forestry sector up to forestry scientists.
you know, we need water scientists working in that space, and technology scientists and everything, and development scientists, and see if we can create more jobs and more growth from those sectors, similarly with food and agriculture. So hopefully that answers some of the questions. And I'm writing a paper. I'm not sure what that means. Then the next question from Member Krumhoff. So I speak as an amateur geologist in this space, and the Holocene and the geological history of our planet is fascinating. I think, you know, the evidence is out there that about 10,000 years ago we ended our last ice age. And ice ages are caused by limitations to the amount of sunlight and solar radiation reaching the planet. And there are multiple causes, and the scientists are keeping themselves very busy debating, you know, this topic. And so it, you know, has to do with the composition of the atmosphere, were there atmospheric chemicals preventing sunlight getting to the planet, also our distance from the sun, which changes over time. And then finally also, the more ice you have, the more reflection you get. So that albedo effect actually keeps the planet cooler. And so that seems to have changed about 10,000 years ago due to a combination of those factors, atmospheric, distance from the sun, plus the amount of ice retreating at that time. The debate is about also whether we are just in an interglacial period, or whether we're just a short break between ice ages, or whether that was the end of the ice age. So I think, you know, studying the past and studying the future is what keeps us very busy. And it does seem, you know, your questions around are we going to enter another ice age, it's also, you know, a very valid question, and one that I don't think we have clear answers to yet, and much divided opinion on that. Your other question about what happened in 1950 is again one that has everyone very busy answering it. I think it did have a lot to do with things that happened during the war, the Second World War specifically. My personal favorite was that it allowed women to enter the workplace for the first time because all the men were away. And we're very good for the economy, as we're seeing here in South Africa too. So that's my personal favorite explanation, is the number of women who then started to work in factories, work on land. But there are also many other reasons that the sort of science and technology that had gone into developing the technology and knowledge for war, you know, was now there and well developed and able to be harnessed in other areas, like links between the weapons manufacturing and our ability to make better fertilizers with our chemical knowledge that had been fostered during the time. So I think it was just that, you know, in that way, wars are hotspots of innovation when they're at that scale. And that probably had a lot to do with the fact that it was very easy then to move into massive innovation in agriculture, massive innovation in industry, and other services too. So those would be, and your interesting comment on Anthropocene Holocaust, I mean, that is really what, you know, really of essence here is the power we have to chart our future, and the importance of decisions being made now to make sure we're, you know, the Anthropocene is going to be good for some people. Some people will benefit from climate change. Some people will benefit from elite capture and those sorts of things. But it's unlikely to be good for us here, so, unless we do some, make some important decisions. And I think that's why I try not to create this as a talk of fear and a talk of doom. There is a talk of potential and possibility, but it really is about making decisions now that react to this too. Thank you.
Thank you. We note the comments made by Robert Kelly, and I think key, like, really is the fact that we live in a very dynamic world, and I think what's key to the work that we have been doing is the value of appreciating our ability to improve our resilience as a people and as a country to respond to some of these challenges, but also to improve our adaptive capacity where we can, as you know, the world changes, we can also respond in a similar way. For instance, some of the things that we have taken for granted, like where we build our homes, for instance, on the, like, you know, right of the seafront, on the back there, so are things that we cannot, are things that we can no longer, like, I mean, do. And I think that both from a planning point of view, in terms of local government planning or municipal planning, for use, allowing the buffer zone and ensuring that the dunes are maintained and are kept in their intact state, is key to managing, you know, those natural, you know, the effect of the supposed natural disasters like sea level rise. It was interesting to see, for instance, in New York, Hurricane Sandy, like on the east coast of the United States, they show areas where there had been constructed dunes, that is, you know, that had been put in place as part of managing, the effect of sea level rise. Municipalities or counties that had put those in place, even though they were not welcome at the beginning, when people wanted to have sea view, wanted to have easy access to the coast. But those areas are actually much less damaged compared to areas that are quite open, where construction or homes and development actually happen right in front of the coastal zone. So I think that one of the things that is clear is that the science that we are doing needs to inform planning, it needs to inform policies around how can we adapt and make our communities much more resilient in the face of the changing climate. And the Honourable Masako's questions are noted as well. The question about where was Africa during the Federation is a difficult one to but what we represented a global average, but we also think that it might have been also due to differences in Africa's political development, the end of colonialism, more focus on rebuilding African states, sometimes characterized by instability. And I think the nice thing about this program, this new global research program, Future Earth, is that we are now going to be looking at some of the societal challenges from a much more integrated way, where we're looking at social sciences as well as the biophysical sciences coming together, natural sciences coming together. Whereas in the past, if we were concerned about agriculture, we would look at agriculture, engineering, and then the social sciences would be in another building, in another distant faculty. So I think there is a recognition that our problems are much more complex and they're not disciplined, organized. And so perhaps we will be able to respond much more.
African Federation is speaking tonight.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is, if we are looking at all of the signs, and I think everybody is recognizing that it is actually African time. And the African Federation is actually beginning, and so the question is, for Africa in particular, is how do we do things differently from how other, developed countries did? Our development pathways can be different, and I think that the work that we are doing can potentially play a role in contributing to development scenarios or planning for development scenarios that are less fossil fuel dependent, that are less damaging to our communities, that build more resilient, more adaptive, more healthy communities, more equitable communities, reducing inequality, reducing poverty. So I think that it is those kinds of futures that Africa should proactively engage in planning and in directing, rather than sitting back and watch as things happen. The question around the capability to advise, I think the CSIR has recognized, and I think the CSIR Act as well mandates the CSIR to contribute to basically national development through supporting government, supporting our society, our nation to make informed decisions that would lead to industrial development and would lead to international development. We have capabilities in a wide range of areas, and we have actually contributed in many ways to sections of the national development plan. We also contribute quite substantially to advice, for instance, to and I'm now talking within the Natural Resources and Environment Unit, to Water, Department of Water and Sanitation, to Department of Environment Affairs,
in the areas that areas where we've got the relevant capabilities, whether it is climate modeling, developing South Africa climate model that is parameterized with local parameters rather than more general global parameters. We are working at understanding South Africa's water resources and contributing to development of national strategies around that. We have signed MOUs with Department of Environment Affairs, with Department of Water and Sanitation, and those are facilitating collaboration between the CSR, enabling the CSR to finesse its capabilities in order to be able to advise the department. But in the life, for instance, advise even on international treaties that South Africa is a part of in the area of biodiversity and ecosystem services, and visit on international science committees and providing support to national delegations to this to their conventions. And so we are positioned as an institution to support government, and I think to make decisions. And I think that there is a growing recognition that our work can actually contribute to decision making for future planning. And I think when we, in our planning cycle, this kind of year's planning cycle, we basically issue a touchpoint of the national development plan and say, how are we helping our country respond to these areas that are relevant to the work that we do. And we are hoping that we will be in a position to advise basically all the relevant line departments that we've got capabilities. But we're also looking at areas where, for instance, that we identify as priorities, where we don't have capability, where we can say, how do we grow capability in this area in order to an example of that is in modeling, basically whether we're talking about climate modeling, hydrological modeling or modeling, we have identified that area and we have built capacity over the years to actually model various systems. And the other one is coastal engineering research capabilities, and we are responding by augmenting our current capacity to respond to those challenges. So I think it would be good as well where, for instance, let's say either the community or the department can say, as a country, we would like to be able to do A, B, C, and D, but we don't have current capabilities. What do we need to do in order to invest in developing those capabilities? Because growing investment in science or in R&D also requires growing capability, both in terms of infrastructure, institutions to manage the expanded research and development portfolio, but also growing people to actually do the research. And I think that those are some of the things that are quite essential for us to think about. We wanted just to give our students an opportunity as well to respond.
Chair, just one thing I wanted to add to that. Just recently, Portfolio Committee also had a briefing by the National Advisory Council on Innovation. Now, one of the outputs of the ministerial review, Minister Pandor's review, was in fact to have a revised National Advisory Council on Innovation report to the minister. And what is now happening, in light of the questions that Seko is asking, is that all the CEOs of all the science councils sit on this advisory council and advises then the minister on some of these very high-level issues. So over and above also working with departments, having MOUs and so on, there's also the cross-cutting advisory level by all the science councils in the country to the minister. And that, I think, I would want him to beef up in that case and see what supports that.
Okay, I just wanted to say that humans are not separate from nature, that we're all part of this socio-ecological system. So, okay. We are part of the socio-ecological system, so a lot of the time we think that humans are destroying nature and not really part of nature, there's humans and then there's nature. But we actually part of an interdependent system, and humans are quite dependent on the benefits that nature provides us. So it's a very complex system in which we're living in.
And I think we're realizing more and more that that we're living in a system and that our actions in one part of the landscape will have trade-off or consequences in a different part of the landscape. Like for instance, if you're upstream of a catchment, what you're doing there will impact people that live downstream of that catchment. So for instance, with pine plantation, as we are becoming more and more aware of our impact, it's important to change our management systems. We have to change from traditional management systems to more appropriate systems. So for instance, with pine plantations, a lot of felling was done in winter, where you will have lots of rainfall, but then because there's no trees, there's no land cover, and that will actually increase flooding because there's no trees anymore to catch some of that water. So things like that are just what are our impacts and what are the consequences of our impacts. And so we start to think more of humans in nature as how we live in this ecological, social ecological system, and not humans and nature and how we control nature so that it benefits us. Thank you.
I want to add to the conversation about development and environment. And as somebody who's trained in economics myself, there's a lot of recognition that maybe economics is placed within the environment. So the graph that Bill put on here, we have the environmental limits aside and the societal requirements inside, is that you can have the economy developing within those bounds, and the environment in a sense is beyond butterflies. Just the fact that it gives a lot of things. It gives our sources of support, our sources of food, our sources of health, and just recognizing that you can place your development in a sustainable path, which is not destructive, and do that while you're still improving food security, you're still improving health, you're still improving the human conditions. So it doesn't have to be one or the other, but it could be sustainability in one which has minimum impacts on the other. Thank you.
In fact, you were faster, Linda. We won't comment that. No, we won't pass that. Even when the ones were supposed to make a decision, they have passed. In fact, you started by saying the Tabofe is very innovative. The other one is not home, so that is an innovation. There's something interesting. I'm not sure whether you saw it, but there's something very interesting. Maybe Natasha and this boy would know that in KZN, there's a beach where you can go there without clothes. I think I'm not sure whether it's an innovation or the fact that they're still coming in. But the problem is we go there, we'll have to go there naked. I'm not sure whether members here will follow our questions. But I think someone on the kid at this moment.
You know, as they speak, and I try to check the load that they are carrying, and do we have the proper net to carry? What are the changes that are there? But of course, you try to talk to that in your comment when you said in areas where there's no capacity. You create it, you know, so that you are able to respond to that. But in terms of from where you are, because not that you are sure, not independent, you are part of a department. But the way you look at things, you
you are not, you know, us here in Parliament, we look at things from the perspective of Parliament, and sometimes we don't see our shortcomings, or sometimes we think we are on the right track while we, those who are at a distance, see us, you know, doing things that we are not supposed to do. Equally from where you are, and the department and government in general, the thinking, are we having the right thinking, or are we having the right attitude towards what you see and what you think, with how we must act to ensure that what you see, like the issues you are raising, we make decisions today that will safeguard generations to come. Because there is a joke, but it's not a good joke. But never, let me just say it, that they've killed their elephant, they've finished them, and the ivory, they use it for different things. We have surplus elephant, but they are not allowed to kill them. You know, I must use correct word, otherwise I will be irresponsible. So we are not allowed to kill them and then take that ivory and openly sell it, not through clandestine means. And we can't do that. I'm saying it's not a good joke, because it's, you know, in most cases those who kill all their elephants are in Europe, and here in Africa we still have them. They come and visit to see them. But that aside, what I pick up from the gentleman who sits behind this poll, as he is speaking, or as you're speaking collectively, all of you, I get a sense that yes, we have an opportunity as a continent to be developed like the developed world, but develop differently. You know, being developed, but ensuring that they don't kill the elephant to achieve what they achieve. We must achieve it with our elephant still intact. And if we can successfully do that, we stand a better chance to extend the life of the universe, you know, because we will have contributed to dealing with the challenges that are there, which is a problem in terms of what we do every day, as we smoke, as we do this, the ice is gradually melting there, and they will wake up where there is water everywhere, particularly where we are now, because I'm told we are below 11. So yeah, but that's the comment, but also there is a bit of a question in it, Chair. Thank
you. Maybe that's the last comment and question, so it's up to you, Belinda, in terms of how you respond.
Okay, so we'll do it. Thank you. It's a very, very good question, but and I don't think we have talked a lot about it, so I'm going to give you off top of our head response to it. But I think the first part perhaps is that yes, there are challenges, and I think one of the challenges has been the fact that the science investment in R&D is really the first place to cut when we are looking at, you know, ensuring realigning priorities, because it is investment into a long-term future. I think that it's something that even when we're doing that tightening, we need to always consider that this is an important space, and that you don't get instant results, but you build gradually over a long term in order to get returns from investment in science. I think second to that, it is investment in development of young you know, scientists. It's the future, basically, of the science in our country. We have done some things that we have seen as quite positive in terms of investment in development,
of human capital. And I think, I mean, there's the two colleagues here, Odi and Ruzi, are a couple of some of that. It is a commitment that requires resources to sustain, especially for people, for young South Africans to stay in science in the midst of a wide variety of other options, you know, people coming in out, because we use young people with skills that would allow them to get into any of the very attractive jobs, because they've got maths and science backgrounds, and they do usually science, engineering, undergraduate degrees. And so they could proceed to pursue engineering options or other attractive job opportunities. But I think to keep them in line, they need to stay for much longer in school. And I think to supporting the department, DST, and supporting institutions like the CSIR in investing in human capital development is a very important contribution that I think the committee can make to support South Africa's contribution to its development through informed planning and policy coming from the science that we do. But I think the other part is also perhaps create more opportunities for interactions like this in various areas, maybe even if it's once in a while, invite another in unit of the CSIR or another program where we're doing leading research, and open that up to members of the community, to the department, and create and try and close the chasm between policy making and planning as well as science. I think there needs to be a much more seamless collaboration between the scientists who are doing the science, the planners, and people who are implementing at government level, as well as policy makers. I think if we can close those gaps, there are areas where we are doing better than the others, but there are a lot of areas where we could do better to close the gap. And I think that if we could achieve that, we would move at a faster rate as a country in terms of closing some of the gaps. The example is in the water service delivery space. The water, we have explored, I think, in the country about 90% of our water storage capacity. So it means we do not have much more room to build more dams and more storage capacity for water. So what we need to do is to improve efficiency in managing the resources that we have and ensuring that we reduce wastage, as Honorable Maseko was talking about earlier. But that is not a problem of insufficient science about what we need to do. It's a question of how do we manage the infrastructure and the resources that we have efficiently. And I think that's where advice needed, where there's support needed in order to improve efficiency there, then we need to harness those from the resources that we have in our country. And I think I go back to the point that Michelle was making. We have quite substantial capacity in a lot of areas, and we need to learn to tap into that in order to contribute to our country development.
I don't have too much to add. I really like your analogy of a future that is good for us and good for Athens. And I think that's really what is kind of understood in this idea of a good Anthropocene, where I think we've got a lot of knowledge built on how others have developed. So we could do a little leapfrogging too, which I think would be very relevant. I think the other point to add to what Lucinda is saying is that these are really important learning spaces for us as well. Everyone always assumes that scientists come into space to just impart the information. But there is no way we would know what science is needed or what capabilities are needed if we weren't participating in these kinds of fora, engaged in the policy debates, and also part of things like the National Development Plan and work going on in departments, even the private sector. And it's been really useful, that the work that the students are taking on isn't just something we came out of a hat with, it was informed by what people were asking us, to develop more knowledge and more data and more information on. So we really see these kinds of forums really important in making sure our science remains relevant and useful in all the contexts we've been talking about today. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Just two comments. I would appreciate if you can't make it a small self-effort. Because if you could meet him, he would actually escalate the price. Because the family is actually at the border of Lesotho. And he said, and there's a lot of water there. And he doesn't know it. So he would escalate the price and say, no, I've charged him a very small amount. And I'm told that the battle is going down for Christmas. We don't want you to comment about it because we like it like that so that we can drive our car, especially our car. Whether we produce the atmosphere, it doesn't matter, but these are elected members and they are elected by you. And they are the last people to make policies and laws in the country. So the reason why we wanted you to talk to them is to make sure that they understand what's happening and they understand where we come from and the future. So that when they make the laws, when they oversight and they make policies and the laws, they make them to look into the future so that they don't destroy our beloved country. Now they want to sit down and they are transversal because they are in the Professional Committee of Science and Technology. So all these other departments, they can call them and say, no, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? Why, Minister, are you making such policies which are going to be detrimental to us? We are hoping that they can listen to them when they make suggestions with the information that they have given them. You can make all sorts of information and advice, but if the leaders don't take it, they will just leave it. They'll need to drop there and remain there. But I'm taking that if it's done the politician, they are the last people to make decisions and debate it and say this is what we will do. But this doesn't remove that part of dynamism. That even if we make laws today, we might change them next year depending on the information that you are giving us. That's how important it is. And obviously when we look at these things, much about balancing things, the important thing is to regulate. We don't want to over-regulate, neither to under-regulate, but to regulate so that there's harmony in living in this world. All of us benefit in this business. And obviously doing that, integrating the work that we're doing. So that's what we're going to be doing. So thank you very much for the question. And we encourage that should come the core people that are doing, not the people that are doing, but the entities that are going to tell us that this is not asking about your budget. I think if they should let them be chance to tell us what is actually going on. So thank you very much. Remember, thank you very much for the question that you have asked. Even the youth that did not ask because they feel they've got more time to live. So those who interact with you. So we really thank you very much, Natasha is the boy. They are the last ones of the community. They're the last ones. Not just ones because they can lead, but the last ones because they are young. They are not young in the community, but they are young by age. So you can see both of them are not married. The both of them are not married. So if somebody wants something, you can. So thank you very much, members. I think it's a